WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you hear that the president of Planned Parenthood of New York City is Alexander Sanger, the logical question is, any relation to Margaret Sanger? Well, the answer is yes. He's the grandson of Margaret Sanger, the founder of the American Birth Control Movement. When she opened America's first birth control clinic in 1916, birth control was illegal in this country. She spent most of her life trying to change the law and educate men and women about birth control. She died in 1966. We invited Alexander Sanger to talk with us about carrying on his grandmother's work and about the effect of her work on her family. Last month, Planned Parenthood of New York City initiated a new program to train medical residents and physicians in surgical abortion and counseling procedures. He told me why he thought this program was necessary.
Well, the reason we're training doctors is because the medical schools and residency programs are not. A OBGYN resident can go through 4 years of postgraduate training and never do an abortion and not have the training available to him or her. About 12% of the residency programs in the country require abortion training, and about another half have it optional, but relatively few of the residents opt for the training. So we have a whole generation of doctors becoming OBGYNs and never knowing how to perform an abortion.
Now, why do you think it's been so hard for you to find doctors to perform abortions? One reason is obviously that not that many doctors are being trained to perform the procedure. Are there other reasons?
Well, I think there are other reasons. We don't pay a lot, so I think economics enters into it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think harassment, you know, if doctors have a choice between delivering babies and doing hysterectomies and doing fertility work, that's not going to subject them or their families to harassment in restaurants or being stalked or even being shot at. So I think there's a very normal fear among a lot of young doctors. They say, who needs it? You know, why should I do this? So part of our program is to remind the young doctors why abortion was legalized in the first place. And it was legalized at the behest of the medical profession and women's groups because so many women were giving themselves abortions and dying as a result. And so we're trying to get some political motivation and education into our training program. And I think it's going to help. And the long run, I will be training, I think, maybe 30, 40, 50 doctors a year and have other programs replicated around the country.
Has Planned Parenthood of New York City been the victim of much harassment?
We get periodic harassment. Our clinic in Manhattan, a bomb was placed in it about 6 years ago. Fortunately, only the detonator went off and not the whole bomb, or the whole building would have come down. It's a 12-story building. After that, we've just been subject to the usual blockades and picketing. But it's not been as bad in New York City as in the rest of the country. I think most of the violence has been in the heartland and in the South. I attribute that to it's mostly white people in the opposition, and they are trying to stop white women from having abortions. So a city like New York and other major metropolitan centers with large minority populations, those in the opposition don't want to target that. And all you have to do is listen to what they say and read their literature. I mean, one of the groups sent out a letter last year, and it said the white race is contracepting itself out of the mainstream. That's how these people think. It's a white supremacy group, in my view.
That's interesting. So you think there's less concern about women of color getting abortions in New York City?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the opposition has a heavy tinge of white supremacy in it. They are real extremists. This is not to say that there are not valid people with, you know, with valid pro-life views across the spectrum of this country, racial groups and ethnic groups. But the leaders who are the extremists, all you have to do is read what they say, and their extremism comes out.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alexander Sanger. He's the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of New York City. He's also the grandson of Margaret Sanger, who was the founder of the birth control movement. Alex Sanger, did you always feel connected to your grandmother's work?
My grandmother was always a presence around our house, even when she wasn't there. I grew up in suburban New York, and my grandmother was living out in Tucson, Arizona. So I didn't see her a lot as a child growing up, maybe once or twice a year. But we talked about her a lot. I knew from a very young age that she was famous, if not infamous. I knew she had gone to jail. But I knew that the people in our community, anyway, considered her perhaps the greatest woman who ever lived, and you know, the woman who contributed most in this century to women's rights and to human rights. So I had always had that about her. I mean, I always knew that. It was part of growing up, and the belief that you know, women were entitled to equality with men. You know, back in the 50s when I was growing up, that was a fairly radical notion.
Did your mother and father believe that, and did they teach that to you?
Well,
too?
Yeah, they did, and it was really mainly even my mother, who probably had more of an influence on me than even my grandmother did. My mother was Margaret Sanger's daughter-in-law, and their relationship would probably take a full hour on your show to talk about. It was quite something, those two, both competing for the attention of my father. But my mother was a doctor. After she got out of high school back in the late 20s, she was the only person in her class to go to college. And after college, she went to study to be a concert pianist. But her teacher, after a year and a half of study, told her that her hands were too small and she would never make it. And so that didn't stop her for long. She then decided she would become a doctor. And never having taken a science course in her life, went to summer school, took, I think, 5 or 6 science courses simultaneously. And then went to Columbia Medical School, where she was one of 5 women in her class of 120. So I had this, you know, incredible example of my mother working almost full time when I was growing up. So it was a very supportive atmosphere for women being achievers in our family.
Now, I guess it was when you were in college, you wrote your senior thesis on Margaret Sanger.
I did. There are 2 requirements to graduate from Princeton. One is to be able to swim a lap in the pool, and the other is to have to write a senior thesis. The former was pretty easy for me, not for some of my classmates. But writing a senior thesis was a big piece of work, and I was a history major, and I decided, well, why not write about something that, you know, I knew something about and something that would interest me for a year and a half project. And as part of it, I went to see all my grandmother's letters, which are at Smith College and at the Library of Congress, and read them all and read her diaries and really began to learn about her and about what she had gone through and about the effect on my father, which was probably the most personally devastating thing that I, you know, had to learn about, how he grew up and what he had to go through and the scars that were left on him. So I read all that and wrote a thesis. And as I tell students at Princeton, pick a thesis topic that you feel passionate about, because you may end up doing it the rest of your life.
Yeah, you said that reading your grandmother's letters, you realized what a devastating effect her work had on your father. What was the devastating effect? What did you learn about that?
Well, I read, for instance, letters that my father would write home from school. He was sent to boarding school at about age 7 because my grandmother was too busy doing her work and in and out of jail to be dealing with her children. And he was first out in a boarding school on Long Island. And one letter I will never forget, it said, "Dear Mother," he always called her Mother, I walked down to the train station today. You said you'd be on the 7:30 train. You weren't there. I waited for the next 3 trains. You didn't get off. I walked back to school. When are you coming to see me? And it was letter after letter like that of broken promises. Another time, my grandmother was under indictment by the federal government, 9 counts of obscenity, for publishing a newspaper called The Woman Rebel. And she actually, it was a very justified indictment because the newspaper was outrageous. It encouraged assassination, among other things, but that's another long story. But on the night before she was going to go to trial, where she was certain to lose and face 45 years in prison, she decided to skip bail and leave the country to avoid trial. So she took my father and my uncle and my aunt and left them with a neighbor. She literally walked over to a neighbor, knocked on the door, said, "Here are my children. I'm going to Europe." And she left the country for 10 months. So it's that type of thing that my father had to grow up with and learn to deal with and to cope with. And it was difficult for him. He didn't cope very well. He bore the scars throughout his life.
So he was virtually abandoned during part of his life so that your mother could do her work. So that his mother could do her work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was, if not with neighbors, left with aunts, with my grandfather's mother. She helped take care of him. So it was very traumatic.
When your father got old enough to understand the nature of his mother, Margaret Sanger's work, did he believe in that work?
Oh, he believed very strongly in the work. And even though he was a doctor in private practice, he would go out and speak at Planned Parenthood when asked to after her death. And he was on the board of the Margaret Sanger Research Bureau here in New York, which was the clinic my grandmother started in 1923 here in Manhattan. So he was involved tangentially throughout his life, but he really couldn't talk about her. When I was doing my thesis, I would try to come up and talk with him, and he couldn't do it. He would change the subject. Just talking about his mother in the early days was just too difficult for him.
Is your father still alive?
No, he died about 4 years ago, and he died about a year before I took the job at Planned Parenthood. So I'm sorry he didn't live to see me do this. He would have been absolutely thrilled. I think my grandmother would be, she'd be speechless to find me at Planned Parenthood of New York City. I was never exactly my grandmother's favorite. My grandmother believed very strongly in limits and the number of children one should have. She had three herself, and she thought two or three was the right number. Well, I am the fourth of six. And when my mother was pregnant with me, I think my parents drew straws to see who was going to call my grandmother. And I think my mother got the short straw and made the phone call and said, well, Margaret, I'm pregnant again. And my grandmother responded, and I'm quoting, she said, "You have disgraced me. I'm going to Europe." And in fact, she went down and hopped on the Queen Mary and went over to Europe until after I was born. My mother had to make a similar call a few years later to announce her sixth pregnancy with my younger sister. And medical records indicate my grandmother had her first heart attack right about that time.
Oh.
So she did not was not thrilled with her son producing six children.
Do you think your parents just wanted a big family, or do you think this was in part a rebellion against Margaret Sanger?
Oh, I think it's clearly a rebellion in part about my father. My mother wanted to have a daughter, and she was going to go on until she had a daughter. And so we had five boys, and then my sister was born. But I think on my father's part, it was a way of asserting his independence.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alex Sanger. He's the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of New York City. He's also the grandson of Margaret Sanger, the founder of the birth control movement. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Alex Sanger. He's the president of Planned Parenthood of New York City and the grandson of Margaret Sanger. What did you learn about your grandmother's reasons for starting the birth control movement and for opening a clinic in 1916? What had she seen? What had she experienced that led her to take that on as her crusade?
I think the major motivating factor was her mother. Both her parents were Irish Catholics, born in Ireland and came over here, where they met and married. And my grandmother's mother was pregnant 18 times, had seven miscarriages, 11 children, and died at age 49 of tuberculosis and exhaustion from childbirth. And as a result, my grandmother had to leave school to take care of the younger children. And they grew up very poor. I was in Corning, New York recently, where they grew up. And there are literally six or seven or eight houses still standing in Corning where my great-grandfather had his home. And the reason he had so many houses was he couldn't pay the rent. And so he kept on getting bounced from house to house. So it was a pretty tough existence. And it wasn't easy to look up the hill and see the Houghton family that owned the Corning Glassworks in a big mansion on the hill, and they had two or three children, and they were very wealthy. And so my grandmother immediately made the connection between good health and better lifestyle with the number of children one had. Another factor was her father, who was a free thinker. That was the word used back in those days for someone who was a radical. And he invited people like Henry George and Ralph Ingersoll to speak in Corning, and he always imposed on my grandmother the thought that think for yourself, make your own decisions, do what you feel is right, and so the combination of the two left an effect on her. She became a nurse. I don't know why she decided to go into nursing. Maybe it was the only way she thought she could earn a living. Her two older sisters became maids in houses and became private secretaries. But she became a nurse, and the family helped get money together for her to be in nursing school. And then when she was working on the Lower East Side of New York, she saw women who were giving themselves abortions because they could not have any more children. And she was patching them up, and one after another died in her arms, and she finally said, enough, there's got to be a better way.
What did the law have to say about birth control when Margaret Sanger started her clinic in 1916?
The law said that any dissemination of birth control information or devices was not only against federal law but against New York law. But there was an interesting exception in New York law saying that a doctor could give a condom to a man to prevent that man from picking up a venereal disease when he went to a prostitute. That was how the law read in 1916.
Could a woman buy a condom to protect herself against a disease?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. There were condoms available. They were invented. The rubber condom was invented by Mr. Goodyear. You know, you see his blimps over our nation's cities. He invented one in about 1836 in his garage in Connecticut.
I didn't realize he was responsible for that.
Yep. There were earlier versions made out of, you know, the guts of a sheep or a lamb or whatever, but this was the first synthetic rubber version. Mm-hmm. But they were available, but they were illegal, but they were available under the counter. As were various, home remedies and old wives' remedies that were passed down from generation to generation.
Your grandmother not only believed in birth control, she also believed in free love. How did the free love part of her life affect her reputation, do you think?
Well, she kept it pretty quiet. It was probably the scariest part then of her message and is still the scariest part now, which is why she arouses such violent opposition. The fact that women should be able to enjoy sex. This was a radical notion back then, and for a lot of people is radical now. And she practiced it. She had, you know, numerous affairs with a lot of men during her career and while she was married to my grandfather and then while she was married to my second husband, her second husband. And they ranged from, you know, people like H.G. Wells and John Reed, you know, the famous writer, and you know, lots of other notable people of the day, but she kept very quiet about it because she knew that if this information got out, it could destroy her. But she kept all their letters, she wrote about them in her diaries, and she left it all behind for me and other researchers to find.
Your grandmother's single-minded focus on birth control was obviously really good for the movement and not so good for her family. Trying to stand back a little bit and get a little distance on the story, what are your perceptions about the sacrifices great people make, you know, like really people who've been very important politically or socially, the sacrifices they make personally and the sacrifices they've forced the people close to them to make?
Well, I think you have to make that decision, every person, when you're in a movement like I am and like my grandmother started, you know, how far you're going to go, where do you draw the line, how much of a sacrifice are you going to make yourself and for your family? I keep a photograph over my desk of my grandmother with my father and my uncle taken in 1915, and my aunt is not in the picture because she had died 2 weeks earlier. The reason she had died was when my grandmother went in exile in Europe for 10 months, avoiding trial on her obscenity charges. My aunt, then age 4, missed her mother terribly, got weaker and weaker. And when my grandmother finally came back, my aunt just continued to get weaker, even though her mother was back, and died about a week after my grandmother came home of pneumonia. My grandmother then went in 2 weeks later into a photographic studio, took my father and my uncle, and had their portrait taken. And my grandmother looks totally serene and confident and dynamic in her usual way. But the faces of my father and my uncle, they are devastated. I mean, they're just totally destroyed, these two young boys, having just lost their sister. My father especially, because he and his sister were about a year apart. And so I keep that picture over my desk to remind me to get home at night, because I could do this 24 hours a day. I mean, it's a calling. You know, every person has to make that decision for themselves, and every great person who contributes anything to society, whether it's, you know, Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Abraham Lincoln, there are sacrifices. I mean, I am not home at 5 o'clock every night, and I'm out many too many nights giving speeches or doing other things for Planned Parenthood. But I try to find a balance, and I guess everyone has to find it on their own. You know, my grandmother's determination, I saw it once, and it was a searing experience. It was the last time I saw her, actually, about 6 months before she died. We went out to the nursing home in Tucson, Arizona, over Christmas vacation to see her, and she was not well, and was, in fact, lying there in the nursing home, pretty much in a coma. And on New Year's Day, we all trooped in, my father, my mother, and all six of us children. We lined up according to height. And my father, always one for a ceremony, brought a bottle of champagne. And when he popped the cork, my grandmother popped out of her coma because she always loved a drink. And she loved a ceremony. And she heard that champagne cork go, and she said, "I want a drink." And the nurse was there in the room saying, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Sanger, you're not allowed to drink." And my grandmother said, "I want a drink," in a louder and louder voice. And finally, the head nurse heard outside and came in to try to calm things down, and my grandmother kept at it and at it. And finally, the medical director of the facility heard the ruckus all the way down in his office. He came down, and the end result was the last time I saw my grandmother, she was drinking champagne through a straw. And nothing much stopped her from things she wanted.
You are now the president of Planned Parenthood of New York City. Do you feel that you are fighting any of the same battles that your grandmother, Margaret Sanger, fought at the turn of the century?
I'm fighting all of them. I mean, not a whole lot has changed. She had problems with the fact that she couldn't speak in public about birth control. And just last year, we had the gag rule. She had to fight for getting some decent contraceptives in this country. We still don't have a decent contraceptive for every woman. She had to fight the court system and the government. We've been doing that the last 12 years. She had to fight the medical profession because doctors didn't want to get involved. And here I am training doctors in how to perform abortions. And she had to fight the religious community and the religious right and the fundamentalists in the Catholic Church, and I'm doing exactly the same. So I look back somewhat chagrined. She accomplished so much and was one of the great women of the world and of the century and of the millennium even. But, you know, I'm still fighting those battles, and maybe by the time I get done, I'll have made some more progress.
Alexander Sanger, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Alexander Sanger is president of Planned Parenthood of New York City and the grandson of Margaret Sanger. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.